Made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the archive. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we talk about the American West and the Rocky Mountains and the place they hold in our history and in our imagination. Naturalist and writer Gary Ferguson is our guest. His latest book is The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains in the American Mind. Gary Ferguson says in the introduction to the book, "Hardly a story is told of this region in which the land isn't cast as a major character. Over the course of 200 years, these river bends, box canyons, and reaches of tundra have become dog-eared pages of a history both real and imagined, sparking in visitors and longtime residents alike flashes of dramatic notions about the past." That's our jumping-off point this afternoon. Gary Ferguson is the author of 6 books, including Hawk's Rest, A Season in the Remote Heart of Yellowstone, and Shouting at the Sky, Troubled Teens and the Promise of the Wild. His writing has appeared in many national magazines. He lives in Montana. His new book, The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains in the American Mind, is published by W.W. Norton. Gary Ferguson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Celeste. Thank you.
Sure. I think I read somewhere that you're a native of South Bend, Indiana.
I am indeed, and I always have described that area as being, to my way of thinking, somewhat topographically challenged, shall we say. And I recall when I was 9 years old somehow getting my hand on a magazine called Colorado Rocky Mountain West, and spent the next couple of weeks in the basement eyeing all those beautiful four-color shots of the mountainscapes, and announced to my parents soon thereafter that I would be moving to the Rockies, and indeed I did as soon as it was possible.
Yeah. Now, when was your first trip to the Rocky Mountains?
You know, it was actually when I was 10 years old, way back when, in 1966, my parents had decided to take a trip out to the West for the first time, and we went to the Front Range of Colorado, and it was roughly a year since I'd seen those landscapes on the printed page, and they did not disappoint. I was absolutely thrilled, and no sooner had we gotten back than I started plotting my means of return, which I didn't really manage to do until I was a senior in high school, when a friend and I jumped in an old 1964 Pontiac Tempest and headed west, and then I began working as a naturalist through my college years out in the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho, and then as soon as I graduated, moved out west, and I've been either in Colorado or Montana for the last 25 years.
Yeah. Now, when you were a kid of 10 years old, 9-10 years old, what place in your imagination did the Rockies hold?
Well, you know, a couple things were going on for me. Certainly, just the mere sight of them suggested a tremendous amount of adventure, and for whatever reason, who can say the nature of our souls, if you will, but I just felt very compelled to get into that level of wildness. I thought to be in a place where many of the historic species were still around, including in the northern Rockies, grizzly bears and mountain lions and all of those kinds of things. I desperately wanted to see them, but I also have to say that nature in general, primarily nature in Indiana, had provided me with a real sense of not just adventure as a child, but by the time I got into high school, there was a certain ability to go out into nature and somehow feel like who I was okay. And little did I know it at the time, but many of the people who came to the Rockies later on, whether it was I don't mean after my life, but many of the people who came to the Rockies after the first reports of them from Lewis and Clark tended to be people who also needed a landscape in which they could feel okay, whether it happened to be black men escaping slavery in the South and becoming trappers, or women fighting for equal rights coming out to the Rockies and finding much more encouragement for such thought. That has been somewhat of a perennial theme in these mountains.
Yeah, a chance to be one's own person.
Yes, and it's remarkable how often groups who were, in my way of thinking, sort of ahead of their time as far as what they wanted to achieve and couldn't find acceptance for that back in the East found a considerable amount of acceptance out in the Rocky Mountains. You tend to think of the West perhaps as being riddled with testosterone, which parts of it certainly are, but for those who were black sheep, I guess you could say, and their opinions were not embraced by the culture as a whole. There was tremendous acceptance out in these mountains, and as an individual, I have to say, I found a lot of that as well. Even when I was in my beginning struggles to be a writer, I found the most rural of people, while they might not have understood what I was talking about, they wished me well and thought it was a great adventure, and I appreciated that perspective very much.
Yeah, well, I don't think of South Bend as particularly buttoned down like New York City, but yet, you know, you go out west, further west, and the buttons, there are no buttons on the collars, are there?
No, that's exactly right, and it's funny, especially when you look at the young, vibrant women, young women of the 1880s and 90s who were desperately struggling for equality and finding no acceptance for that in many of the folks of their parents' generation. They were still expected to go even to resorts on the Atlantic shore and in the Catskills and dress in petticoats and corsets and never break a sweat. And when they came out to the dude ranches of the Rocky Mountains in that same era, and especially in the early 1900s, they were encouraged to get rid of all that uncomfortable clothing, put a pair of jeans and some flannel shirts on, and go rope a cow or fly fish or fix fence and sit at the tables in the cookhouses with the men and share their thoughts and their philosophies. I think it's an intriguing thing to consider that Wyoming Territory granted suffrage to women in 1869, which was 50 years before they gained the right to vote in the United States.
Yeah, and also African American.
Yeah.
People were able to go west before the Civil War. They were going west and were able to make their own way and to be out from underneath the restrictions and the repression abuses of white Eastern America.
It's a stunning thing to consider a man like Edward Rose, who came from a slavery region of the Southeast, where he would have been considered literally less than human, and 4 years later he had gained a tremendous reputation as a trapper and was considered more or less a co-chief of the Crow tribe and in control, if you will, of some 7,000 square miles of land. Similarly, Black Harris, when he came out west, he was the guide of choice for many very difficult, dangerous missions, and was actually the leader who helped the first two Anglo women across the Rockies on their way to missionaries in the Oregon Territory. A very trusted, well rewarded fellow. Even on his epitaph, the epitaph on his tombstone says, "And for the promise of equal rights, he crossed the snowy mountain heights." So, yeah, what an entirely different perspective that these men were able to gain in just a very short period of time.
Yeah. Our thoughts on the West and the Rocky Mountains are tinged with a whole lot of romanticism, though. And you say in the book, much of what has been written about this range is wrapped in enough gush to shame a pack of evangelists.
True.
And I think I really like that because, you know, it is so difficult to sort out our feelings from what does the West mean in our imagination and what is it in terms of rock and water and climate and plants and animals. Where do you begin to sort through, you know, all of these things and bring the picture into some kind of focus?
Well, one of the things that helped me a great deal is to sit in the archives at Harvard and Yale and various other research libraries around the United States and get a sense historically of where we came from as a culture as far as our relationship to nature. And I have to say I was overjoyed to find indicators that suggest why we were so ripe to respond the way we did to a place like the Rockies. First of all, you have many of the most well-known pundits of the 1770s, 80s, and 90s predicting that America would become the most creative nation in the world, that we would actually produce more poets and musicians and artists of all sorts simply because we were rubbing elbows with the woods. By the time Lewis and Clark head west, there's a tremendous debate raging across New England. And one that was of interest to both progressive and orthodox clergy, and it was basically the question was, is nature the hand and voice of God, or is nature God himself? Our wonderful naturalists of the late 1800s, like John Burroughs, making comments like, you know, if we don't go to church as much as our forefathers, we go to nature, we go to the woods much more. And you very quickly get the point that for a good 140 years, I think nature, patriotism, and religion were the three legs of the stool that the culture sat on, if you will. And I had no idea that we had that level of deep affinity. And if I could say one other thing about that, Celeste, this was most intriguing to me. You know, it stands to reason that when we put our John Hancock, if you will, on the Constitution, we would be actively seeking symbols and icons that would suggest what our dreams for the country were. And by that time, people had been on this continent for well over a century, and they were well aware of the fact that nature in general tended to be what they called the great equalizer. And that really had to do with the fact that it doesn't really make any difference how much blue is in your blood or how much cash is in your bank account. When we go out into nature, we are treated equally. And this meant an awful lot to people symbolically because they almost all of them agreed that what we didn't want was a landed gentry system, an aristocracy. We wanted to maintain equal opportunity for all Americans. And so suddenly, as the 1800s blossom, you see wilderness showing up in landscape painting and later in literature being referred to as the promise of a just society, as one of the former editors of Scientific American even described it. And this is where you get the sense by a lot of thinkers that, well, you know, it really doesn't matter if people go out to the places like the Rockies or not. They just knowing that they're there. People like Henry George in 1890 suggested just knowing they're there would help instill in people a consciousness of freedom. And this is what he was talking about. And we've lost touch, and maybe we never learned in the first place in the current generation, that this is our history. This is where we come from. So when you see places being abused, whether it was in the Midwest or the Northeast or the Rockies, it wasn't just offensive to a lot of people because we were compromising natural resources, although that was part of it. It was actually an offense against something that was held to be a sacred symbol of the promise of a democracy.
It's interesting you end your introduction to this book with Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
Wonderful. Sigmund Freud, you say, even that least of all nature boys, speculated that wild preserves served the same function for a culture that fantasy did for an individual.
You know, and Sigmund Freud, it's worth saying, if you wanted to find the poster child for I Don't Want to Be Outside movement, he is the guy. He had no personal fondness for the natural world, but he did make that statement that you just referred to. The thing that's important to me to say about that, though, is he imagined, and the reason he made that statement, he imagined a view and a vision of nature shared by his contemporaries where the wilderness was not just entertaining and it was not just thrilling and beautiful. It was also dark and scary and full of danger and shadow. It was, in other words, the wilderness was a very textured, multidimensional kind of place that Freud thought matched beautifully the human imagination, that we could basically project everything that we both fear and love onto the wilderness. This is what my big concern, to be honest with you, is today about whether or not we will ever find ourselves back to some greater measure of nature renaissance, if you will, because I live at the edge of Yellowstone, and it's alarming to see how difficult it is for people to disconnect from their immediate gratification expectations and their desire to be comfortable, to be entertained but not inconvenienced. We see remarkable comments showing up on the Yellowstone visitor sheets, such as, could you stake out or cage some of the animals so they're easier to see? We have people calling in from cell phones to acquire helicopter rescues when they're simply tired, and no problem if they have to spend $5,000 for the rescue. Many river guides get calls these days from people saying, gosh, I'm coming on August 10th. How many moose will I see? It's ironic because nature used to be held as the kind of the antidote to those kinds of misunderstandings about how life is, from the illusion that you can control life, that there isn't a certain aspect of chaos to every human life. And now I think we're trying to bring those expectations into the wilderness, and it makes for very strange bedfellows.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when I was reading your book, The Great Divide, this new book from you, early on in the 17th century, leaders of the Western world were describing mountains as tumors.
Yeah.
And we go from that to, seeing nature experiencing in a religious way, although really mountains go back in our religious language or in our religious metaphors go back way, way, way back. I mean, go tell it on the mountain. I mean, Moses, the Ark, the mountains are as close on earth as we can get to heaven.
Well, that's very well said. And what surprised me is that while that understanding was very common to, well, let's just pick on Christianity for a second, very common in Christianity for the first 300 or 400 years. In fact, there was the notion that nature could reveal much about the divine, and that with the coming of Christ, not only humans were redeemed, but the earth itself was given a new lease on life. And then around 500 AD, it was decided that by the church fathers to follow a different tack, and basically the storyline for roughly 500 till the later 1500s, early 1600s, so 1,000 years, was that when the world was originally created and the Garden of Eden was in place, it was what they referred to as a mundane egg, that there was not a blip or an irregularity anywhere to be had in paradise. The floodwaters came to punish us, of course, for our evil ways. When the floodwaters receded, there were all these mountains and irregular coastlines in place, and they were put on earth by God, the church leaders said at that time, to remind us of what evil creatures we really were. And so for that entire 1,000 years, I found it very difficult to find any sort of reference to mountains that wasn't carbuncles, blisters, warts, tumors, rubbish heaps. And it was not until the 1600s that started to finally crumble in the wake of science. One thing that had a little bit to do with it was Galileo turning his newfangled telescope to the moon and discovering mountains, and suddenly philosophers saying, well, if God put mountains to remind us of how terrible we are, why would he put them on the moon? And between that and I think an influx of Asian art and the Asian cultures never had the tendency to turn nature into a Stephen King novel, if you will. I think with all that, that's what gave flight to the Romantic era, and it was against that crumbling of that 1,000 years of oppression that people first started coming to North America, and it had a lot to do with, I think, why we were so hungry for what we found here.
Yeah. But then we push westward, and heaps of abuses are piled upon the native populations, and we have this idea of manifest destiny. And today, given what you've said about the comments that you see on the visitors page at Yellowstone, we have maybe manifest Disney.
I like that. I may have to steal that, Celeste. That's wonderful. That's exactly, I think, what we have. You know, I don't see any shortage of hunger. I mean, if I was to leave my house at the end of this conversation and head into Yellowstone, there would be literally tens of thousands of people hungry for any sighting of whatever animal you can name there is on any given day, a long parade of people throwing open the minivan doors and running after various animals with their video cameras. So the hunger is there, but I think we're not able to take nature on its own terms very well anymore. We are trying to apply the expectations of our technological culture to nature itself, and it really is not working out very well. Along those lines, I have to say that much of the writing I've done in the last couple of years has had to do with the Yellowstone wolf reintroduction, and that is the one animal that seems to be able to overcome that unwillingness to take nature on its own terms. For whatever reason, people treat that almost like an archetypal symbol, and they're so anxious to have the slightest glimpse of a wolf that they will set their lawn chairs up at dawn in the Lamar Valley, and if it takes 2 or 3 hours of simply sitting, waiting for the chance to see a wolf, they will do so. And in the waiting process, I've had so many of them tell me that, wow, I had no idea there was so much to be seen. I just need to stop long enough, stop my movement long enough to notice that this just wonderful bounty of activity going on in the woods all around me. And so the wolf has helped to overcome it a little bit, but it's a troublesome thing. I remember reading a wonderful quote from Robert Frost once, who said that most of the changes we think we see in this culture are just old truths coming in and out of favor. And I firmly believe that there is no more fundamental truth in this culture than the power of landscape to define our identity. But whether or not that truth can again find favor, I think, depends to a large extent on whether we're able to engage nature in an imaginative way. For all the wonderful fights that go on to save an environment for the species diversity and watershed protection and other things that are important, I'm not so sure we can sustain those kinds of battles if we don't have imagination as a kind of fuel to keep us getting out of bed and fighting the good fight as the days go on.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Let's say good afternoon to this caller. Hi.
Hi, this has been really interesting. I love the idea of talking about how people are not connecting well with nature. I want to suggest that maybe this goes back to like the 1600s, 1700s, when in the Baroque era they thought that, especially in England, but largely in Europe, they thought that nature could be ordered clearly and easily. It went along with the music that they had. It went along with the social order that they desired. It went along with the idea that nature is pretty and perfect as it is. And they created these beautiful gardens that reflected that kind of attitude. And I think that overall attitude or perspective has come down, especially for people who have never had a chance to actually go into the woods. And the fact is, the woods are messy. The woods are not neat. The woods are chaotic. And there certainly is an overall order, but I think that people who have never been in the woods don't really appreciate that. That goes back to that comment that you made about folks going into the woods and sitting there waiting for the wolves and then realizing, hey, there's a lot going on. And I think part of our problem as a society, there are so many people who, when they see nature, what they see nature is in a park where everything is carefully laid out. They go to the botanical gardens if they ever get there. They see, even in the suburbs, everything is laid out in perfectly grid pattern organizational structures, and they don't understand that nature has got tons of stuff going on at all kinds of different levels.
I think that's a splendid point, and if you don't realize that nature does have all that going on at all those levels, of course your imagination is not fully engaged. You can only think of it in the terms you've just described, which tends to be an ordered, logical, almost reducible to mathematical formula kind of perspective.
Exactly.
I remember a couple of years ago, I stumbled across, and this is not unusual, by the way, sad to say, a woman was in Yellowstone, and it was the fall, I think early October, and the elk were in in rut, and they're very unpredictable and dangerous during that season. And she was trying to stand her young 6-year-old, 5-year-old boy next to an enormous bull elk for a photo opportunity. And I happened to say something, I thought fairly nicely, that, gee, that's not a good idea. And she was incensed. She said the Park Service wouldn't let these animals run around if they were dangerous. So, you know, I think you've hit on a key aspect that we need to pay attention to. You know, ironically, it seemed like we broke free of some of that thinking, some of that overly ordered thinking in the 1700s and 1800s. I remember Thomas Cole and the Hudson River School painters celebrating that kind of unkempt look and that unpredictability of nature, and that seemed to carry us forward, I would say, almost, in at least in some circles, through roughly the 1920s and 30s. But then post-World War II, when we started coming back out to the Rockies in a big way, whatever willingness we had to embrace nature on her own terms to a large extent vanished, and I'm not really sure why that was.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, to me, it seems very relevant to the mechanization of society, to the industrialization. Everything has a place. Everything has an order. If you went out on the street today and you asked 10 people what a good garden looks like, my guess is that they're going to tell you there are neat little rows, and their plants are spaced out according to a predetermined plan, and that's the way nature is.
Yeah.
And I think it's the whole mechanization of society, it's the whole structuralization, it's the fact that we are so hierarchy-dominated in terms of our thinking about how humans should be organized. It makes perfect sense to the unthinking person, to the unconscious person, that, hey, nature should be the same way. And I think a lot of people, since so many people live in urban or even suburban environments, they don't recognize the idea that nature is wild and uncontained and uncontrolled, and it does grow toward patterns, but the patterns are not the same kind of patterns that humans are used to working with and used to.
Do you have any sense of whether or not we can, you know, transcend that that overly ordered expectation, or is this, in your due way of thinking, just kind of the way things are going to be and maybe worse as time goes on?
Oh, for me, it's experience. It's when people get out into the woods, when people get out into nature, then they start to see that, you know, the chaos of nature is not a complete chaos. It's a chaos at the surface level. There is a big organizational structure, but it's a little bit bigger than what we're used to thinking of.
Right.
And I think that when people see nature, when they get out and experience it, then maybe it's that chaos becomes less frightening. It becomes less scary, less like an unknown, and more acceptable, more tolerable. I don't know if those are the right words.
Yeah, I wonder if even our ability to be so-called on vacation has grown so so controlled and so minimal in this culture. I mean, we're the only industrialized nation in the world now that doesn't have a national paid vacation requirement. Even China has three weeks that everybody is guaranteed to have. And, you know, that may drive some of the unrealistic expectations that I see in Greater Yellowstone, because people only have, you know, maybe 5 or 6 days to spend here, and they're absolutely so worried that everything come off without a hitch, to the point where if they go on a raft trip and the weather doesn't cooperate, I've had guides tell me that they won't tip them because somehow the guide might have been at fault for you know, their vacation going a little sour. So maybe we just need a little bit more time off to slow down.
Yeah. Well, I really like the idea of slowing down and being in wilderness as much as I'm able to cope with it. I mean, you know, I'm not very capable, you know, in the wilderness, in the wild. And I do love my garden.
Sure.
I like both of those things. But I also like Freud, even though I'm not scared of being outside. You know, I like the idea of it.
Sure.
And I also wonder if there have been times in our history when we're when we move toward that idea of wildness. I mean, I know that you write in this book about dudes, the people that went out at the beginning of the 20th century for vacations, and for, you know, and to breathe in the fresh air, and then in the 60s and 70s, you know, we had hippies, we had people who wanted to go back to the land and get away again from the restrictions of settled places.
Right. You know, and I think that has a lot to do with those earlier comments by the pundits that we would be the most creative nation in the world from rubbing elbows with Woods, I think that there's this general understanding, or at least there was, that an ability to at least imagine nature was a critical aspect of the creative mind, and that nature actually prompted the imagination, and the imagination, of course, in turn served, as Einstein said, both art and science. And I understand what you're saying. And, you know, the comment about the garden, I think it's important to make the remark that I don't believe everybody has to come to the wilderness in order to foster a deep and abiding love of the wilderness. I think that a relationship with your tomato plant growing on the upper stoop of your Manhattan apartment can also suggest what, across some 3,000 years of nature mythology, were the three critical aspects of what nature told us about living well in the world. The first was to have some relationship with beauty, the beauty of the natural world, and they usually refer to that as an active, dynamic relationship where beauty could actually move you and motivate you to do and to become who you were meant to be. And then the second theme was nature providing a sense of mystery, a transcendent mystery, mythologists call it, so you can have a sense that, boy, there's much more to the world than what science has been able to nail down or what I can even imagine. And the third was the importance of community, both community of human souls, but also community as far as the other creatures that inhabit the planet. And I think you can get those three lessons from gardening and from being in relationship with a myrtle patch or whatever happens to be your little patch of nature. You don't have to necessarily do what I do and throw on a pack and, you know, walk off for 3 months into the wilderness.
Mm. Gary Ferguson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains in the American Mind. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line, Line 4 in Spring Bay.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Really.
Hello.
Enjoyable conversation. I wanted to add to what the previous caller was talking about with the neoclassical gardens. I enjoy reading and going and attending Shakespeare. And the thing that I like about Shakespeare so much is he uses nature references so easily. And that got me to thinking how really removed from nature we are today. And you were expressing earlier about what are the trends? And I think the trend has got to be to continue becoming more and more distance from nature, the population explosion and all of that, living in urban settings and not having any real meaningful contact with the natural world.
I worry about the same thing. On as many mornings as not, I wake up and conclude much the same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, with the gardening, I think eating food that, I mean, we can go to the grocery store and get a strawberry in January. We don't live according to natural rhythms anymore, or at least it's really masked, very, you know, we got all kinds of clutter in front of it. And
I wonder if that may even have something to do with what is often reported as to be an unusual unwillingness in this culture to deal with death, human death. I mean, arguably, somebody who lives closer to nature would see death as such a theme, death and life, as such a cycle, an inevitable cycle, that only somebody divorced from nature could actually entertain the notion that somehow we may be able to transcend even death or put it off for far longer than we were probably meant to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Shakespeare because I recall a couple of historians, many of them actually from the 18th century, talking about the fact that when a lot of the Anglos came over to North America, and I'm not talking about the Puritans, they truly did see a devil behind every tree, but many of the other Europeans and people from Great Britain did not, and the French especially were more than willing to hang out with the Native Americans and, you know, in truth, even those who didn't show such willingness. There's an old saying that you can't invade a culture without being invaded back. But they were famous for taking bits and pieces of the Native American mythologies and weaving them into their own Anglo story traditions. And so at one point we see the word Puck show up in Shakespeare's work, which of course does refer to a sprite, and there's some speculation about whether or not that came from the word Pukwudgie, which was a term that the Penobscot used to describe little vanishers, essentially a sprite-like character. And there's some thinking that maybe Shakespeare's countrymen came back loaded with all this wonderful nature imagery that, to no small extent, he leaned on himself.
Yeah. Well, his use of nature references, it was just so clearly understood by his audience.
Yes.
And today, I think our literary references, allusions, similes, what have you, would be perhaps more oriented toward technology, toward manufacture, toward less away from the natural world, which he used so freely. Even in the Baroque era, they were, they didn't have access to food the way we do today, so that they were still living closer to a natural order, I think, and when you can go and get a strawberry in January, it really, I think, does significantly reduce your connection to nature.
Well, even if we can't, maintain the former connection to be able to prompt our imagination by visualizing wild nature, do you think that maybe through art or some other means we could at least reclaim kind of the creative territory that to some degree we seem to have lost?
Boy, that's a great question, and I suppose off the top of my head, I would say I don't think so.
Yeah,
because it's such an immediate, a visceral experience that I don't know whether there would be any substitute for it.
I'd like
to ask a question, then I'll get off and let someone else get on. But
okay.
You mentioned Celeste mentioned one of your other books that got me to thinking. When American Indian kids came of age, they went off for a vision quest in the mountains by themselves and sat, they were alone, the way I understand it, maybe for the first time in their lives, but
yeah,
totally
yeah.
alone, and they would come back. And I've often thought, would that be a good experience for a troubled teen living in some city, to go off and spend time alone in the wilderness and possibly as a result of that have a new appreciation of what living in society does for all of us, what it contributes, and how we can become maybe better social creatures. And I'll get off and listen. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm really glad you asked that, because, in fact, a number of years ago I wrote a book called Shouting at the Sky that was based on a very successful, compassionate, therapy-based wilderness recovery program, if you will, for severely at-risk teens who were 14 to 17 years old, middle class to some upper middle class kids. And that was exactly what that program was about. It was 2 months in the wild where they did not see a shred of civilization. And these were kids who did not want to necessarily, when they first came, be there. It would probably have ranked at the bottom of their list of places to go. But other therapies and intervention had not helped them, especially with drug addiction, which was prevalent among this group. And in fact, that particular program and other good compassion-based programs, I'm not talking about boot camp here at all, they're showing right now, according to latest studies, a success rate with drug addiction of about 65% with that population. Now, that's a fairly impressive statistic when you consider that the success rate in treating drug addiction in teens at in standard 28-day lockdown therapy is about 22 or 23%. The difficulty, even with that wonderful, powerful effectiveness, and the kids, it's funny, the kids, when I ask them, why do you think this worked, they describe exactly those three themes that I mentioned earlier from nature mythology. They say, well, it was the first place I've really ever been in what I consider beauty. They say it was the first time I've ever had a sense of the spiritual. In other words, you could replace that word with the mysterious. And they say, as often as not, that was the first place where what I did mattered. In other words, they're speaking to that community issue again. The trouble for them is, while Tecumseh may have come off of his vision quest back to his culture there in Chillicothe and been welcomed with open arms and acknowledged that he was no longer the same person, a lot of these kids went back to their homes and their peers said, well, so you went to summer camp. Who cares? In other words, there was not even the language in the culture for them to express the power of what they had gone through, and it took a lot of very, very serious effort on their parents' part as well as theirs to maintain a psychological community, if you will, so they could keep what they learned alive.
Hmm. Let's talk with, I want to thank that caller for his call, and I want to go on to our next caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. You just touched on the notion that we have to, and I can't repeat the exact words you used, so maybe you can, that our country has to get back to its identity of being connected with the land. And I was just wondering how you connect that to the notion of manifest destiny and environmental protection and environmental consciousness, or even, you know, we are a country, we have borders, and we have a certain amount of land, but how our actions vis-a-vis our sense of ourselves, our land, our environment, connect with the rest of the world in terms of imperialism or, you know, capitalism or, you know, global warming or anything like that?
What a wonderful question. You know, I have a problem with manifest destiny. It certainly got the job done, and the job as defined even in the late 1700s was to claim that we had a God-given right, and it was inevitable that we would claim the continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific. That in and of itself, you can argue whether that was a good thing or not. But what happened during the early 1830s and certainly well through the 1840s and 50s was that mythology was invigorated, shall we say, by those powerful politicians, and I'm thinking of men like Senator Thomas Hart Benton, who stood to gain a tremendous amount of wealth from us acquiring that land. And so not only was the myth still in place that we should do this, but in order to accomplish the myth, Benton and a lot of others started talking in what I consider very, very openly racist fashion and putting in opposition to the storyline the Indians and the land itself. And this does not suggest the common experience of the land at all, but it set in motion this notion that, yes, the mountains were nothing but a terrible obstacle for us to overcome. You had senators saying, I wouldn't give $5 for the entire Rocky Mountain Range, and more problematic still, putting, like I said, the Native Americans in opposition, calling them godless heathens, calling them devils, the children of the devil. And that was not at all a populist perspective, but it was the story that was being told by those with their fingers on the button of myth. And it's especially ironic because to think of Native Americans by that point as being, you know, ignorant savages and children of the devil required a tremendous amount of forgetting. It required us to ignore the fact that historians now openly acknowledge that Benjamin Franklin probably came up with his early draft of federalism by looking at the Iroquois Confederacy, which had provisions for suffrage and recall procedures and referendums, and the fact that Native Americans had written literally, I would say, over 6,000 pieces of English language work on various topics from roughly 1776 to 1920. So we had to ignore all of those accomplishments in order to place a group and to place the land itself in opposition and call that evil. And we do not have to look very far around the world today to see that use of evil being used again as a way to get the populace behind you, to lend a certain righteousness to the cause. And that's a very scary and very abusive tendency. And it worries me because we don't understand or know our own history enough to recognize when we're falling into that trap again, as unfortunately I think we and other leaders around the world have fallen to various degrees often in the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, it seems now that if someone is calling someone else evil, it's a good thing to turn around and look at the speaker and see what they're really trying to do. It's almost, you know, like a projection, like they're trying to hide something else by calling the evil somewhere else. And that may be somewhat simplistic. I'm not to say that there aren't bad things everywhere, but
yes.
I think we have to look at ourselves. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thanks for the call. And we have used up all the time. It went so quickly.
It did. I had no idea we were at the end of the road already, Celeste.
I'm sorry we won't be able to talk with our last listener here who called in Urbana this afternoon. And, you know, we have There's so much more to talk about. Maybe some other point in time here, Gary, we could talk with you again about some of the ideas and some of the things that you write about in this book. There's so much here. I was particularly touched by the stories you tell, that you touch on, from remarkable American Indian women.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I mean, and Sacajawea is only the tip of the iceberg. Tremendous women who helped a lot of the scientists and sociologists and anthropologists who were studying those cultures. They would have never been able to do so without the help of some very intelligent, bright, dynamic women. And that, again, is part of the history that doesn't, unfortunately, get much representation in the Manifest Destiny side of the story.
Yeah, there's a wonderful woman by the name of Catherine,
yes,
who writes about some of the things that we've been talking about here this afternoon, about beauty and chaos and how it comes together and gives us mystery. And I think that was just a remarkable passage in the book for me.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I so appreciate your interest and the comments from your callers. Just wonderful things for me to think about here as well.
Okay. Well, take care, and thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Celeste.
Gary Ferguson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains in the American Mind. It's published by W.W. Norton. And that interview was from July of this year. Good afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's find out what happened today on the CBOT. Here with the numbers, the highs, the lows, and the settlements, Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade today, futures in the bean pit tried to rally just a bit, but that was stymied, and they finished the day lower in the nearbys. The deferreds were a little higher. The trading range fairly wide, 530.5 and 519, the high and the low at the November contract, settled at 524, so you kind of get an idea of what happened there for the day. Still did not manage to put any gains in that. They were down 1.25, but let's start out in the wheat pit where we always do at 1:50 in the afternoon. Central Standard Time for the settlement prices from the board. The December contract, a 307.25 high, low at 299. Their settlement to 306.25, up 3.75. March futures, 319 on the high, the low at 311. Settled at 318.5, they were up 3.75. May contract, 324.5, the high, the low at 317.25. The settlement price at 324, up 3.5 cents. And July futures, 328, the high, the low at 321.25. Settlement price at 327.25. They were 3.75 higher for the day. From the corn pit, futures finished the day a bit higher, up a penny to a penny and 3/4. Across the grains floor, some of the traders were expecting yesterday's crop production reports to show a little better number in terms of harvested, percent harvested at around 25%, came out at 23%, but when you take a look at the numbers of maturity, it sure looks like you're moving very quickly out there to bring in that crop, not only in Illinois, but in a good part of the Midwest, so it may change very quickly in terms of whether they think this is a quick harvest season or not. December futures in the corn pit managed to rally just a bit on the idea things had slowed down. 206 was the high, the low at 202.5. A settlement price at 204.5. They were up 1.75. That also despite the fact that there were two big numbers that came out from Informa and FC Stone above 11 billion bushels. Not too unexpected, but above 11 billion bushels for their prediction for the size of this year's corn crop. That next USDA report due out next Tuesday morning, by the way. The March futures, 216.5 the high, low at 213. Their settlement price at 215. They were up 1.25. Settled once again at 213 in the March corn. May futures, 223.5 high, low at 220.5. Settlement price, 222.25, up 1 cent. And July futures at 229.75 high, low at 227. Settlement at 229. They were up 1.5. And the September futures, 236 the high, low at 234. Settled 235, and they were up 3/4 for the day. December contract, a 244 high, low at 241.75. Settled 243.25, and they finished the day one higher. December oats now, 144 the high, the low at 141.5, a settlement price at 143, up 1/4. And the March oats, a 150.5 high, low at 149, settled 150.5, up 1/4 as well. From the soy complex, the May beans, a 530.5 high, low at 519, settled 524, they were down a penny and 1/4. January, 537.25 the high, the low at 527, settled 532.5, down 1/2. March contract, 544.5 high, low at 533.5, settlement price at 539.25, quarter higher for the day. And the May beans, a 550 high, a 540 low. That's new contract low for the May contract, by the way. 546.5, the settlement price. They did manage to gain today 1.25 points. Soybeans, July contract now, 556.5 the high, the low at 546.5, settled 552.5. They were up 0.5 cents. And the August contract, a 555 high, low at 549, settlement price at 552, and they were up 0.5 as well. One other note on the beans. You'll hear during the closing mark report when we listen to the state statisticians, I believe all three of them talk about bean fires across their states. It's awfully dry in Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa. In fact, I heard of a bean fire just not too far to the north of here in a little town by the Thomasboro. I think that happened yesterday, and they went to town with the tractors trying to make sure that that didn't get hold of a home that sat on that acreage. I hope that they managed to do that. November beans, or rather October bean meal now, 155.40, the high, the low at 152.50, and settlement price at 152.60, they were down 3.30, and December bean meal, 158.90, the high, the low at 156, the settlement price at 156.30, they were down 3.10. October oil from the bean pit, 21.20, the high, the low at $20.44, settled 21.05, they were up 36. And the diesel oil, 21.34, the high, the low at 20.55, a settlement price at 21.16, and they were up 35 for the day. Now here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. Cattle finished higher today, while lean hogs and February bellies finished the day lower. October feeder cattle, the high today 113.30, the low 112.30, the settlement 113.22.5, that up 32.5. November 111.90 the high, 110.60 the low, 111.75 the settlement, that up 72.5. January feeder cattle 108.35 the high, 107.10 the low, 108.35 the settlement, that up 75. October live cattle 86.30 the high, 85.25 the low, 86.17.5 the settlement, that up 35. December live cattle 88.97.5 the high, 87.77.5 the low, 88.82.5 the settlement, that up 55. October lean hogs, 73.75 the high, 72.35 the low, 72.62.5 the settlement, that down 125. December 66.80 the high, 65.50 the low, 65.75 the settlement, that down $1 even. February lean hogs, 66.10 the high, 64.75 the low, the settlement 65.07.5, that down 125. April lean hogs, 63.25 the high, 62.65 the low, 62.75 the settlement, that down 40. And February bellies, 96.90 the high, 95.80 the low, 96.60 the settlement, that down 57.5. The Dow is down 45 points at 10,171. The NASDAQ off a fraction at 1952. And the S&P 500 down 2 at 1133.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Kreiner Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the U of I School of Music Ensemble in Residence, the Pacifica Quartet, the New York Festival of Songs Cabaret at Harlem's Height, and Showtime at the Apollo on tour. For more information, visit KreinerCenter.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ken Gooding from Springfield, Vermont writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what happens if you get scared half to death twice?"
Well, then you're only a quarter here. Many a tenured professor or university administrator displays that effect. Perhaps